This is Audible.
This is a copyrighted work. Unauthorized copying or distribution is a crime punishable by up to 5 years in prison and a fine of $250,000.
Scholastic Audio presents Five Nights at Freddy's, Book 3, The Fourth Closet, by Scott Cawthon and Kira Breed Risley. Read by Susanna Lise Freeman. Chapter 1.
Charlie!
John clambered through the rubble toward the place where she'd been, choking on the dust of the explosion. The ruins shifted beneath his feet, and he stumbled over a block of concrete and caught himself just before falling, scraping his hands raw as he grabbed frantically at the broken surface. He reached it, the place where she'd been. He could feel her presence beneath him. He took hold of an immense block of concrete and hefted it with all his strength. He managed to tilt it from the pile and overturn it, where it fell with a thud, rattling the ground he stood on. Over his head, a steel beam creaked, wavering precariously.
Charlie!
John cried her name again as he shoved another block of concrete away.
Charlie, I'm coming!
He was gasping for breath, moving the remains of the house with desperate, adrenaline-fueled strength, but the adrenaline was running thin. He set his jaw and pressed on. His palm slipped as he tried to lift the next block, and when he looked, he realized, dazedly, that his hands left streaks of blood wherever they touched. He wiped his palms on his jeans and tried again. This time, the broken concrete moved, and he balanced it on his thighs and took it 3 steps away, then dropped it on a pile of debris. It crashed down onto the rubble and shattered rock and glass beneath it, starting an avalanche of its own, and then, beneath the sounds of wreckage, he heard her whisper,
John, Charlie.
His heart stopped beating as he whispered back to her, and again the rubble moved under his feet. This time he fell, landing hard on his back, knocking the wind out of him. He struggled to inhale, his lungs useless, then haltingly he began to breathe. He sat up, lightheaded, and saw what the collapse had revealed. He was in the little, hidden room in Charlie's childhood house. Before him was a plain, smooth metal wall. At the center was a door. It was only an outline, without hinges or a handle, but he knew what it was because Charlie had known, when she stopped running in the midst of their escape and pressed her cheek against the surface, calling to someone or something inside.
John,
she whispered his name again, and the sound seemed to come from everywhere at once, bouncing off the walls of the room. John got to his feet and put his hands on the door. It was cool to the touch. He pressed his cheek to it, just as Charlie had, and it grew colder, like it was draining the warmth from his skin. John pulled back and rubbed the cold spot on his face, still watching the door as the shiny metal began to dull before his eyes. Its color paled, and then the door itself began to thin, its solidity vanishing until it looked like frosted glass, and John saw there was a shadow behind the glass, the figure of a person. The figure stepped closer, the door clarifying until he could almost see through it. He moved closer, mirroring the figure on the other side. It had a face, sleek and polished, its eyes like a statue's, sculpted but unseeing. John peered through the door between them, his breath clouding the near-transparent barrier. Then suddenly, the eyes snapped open. The figure stood placidly before him, the eyes fixed on nothing. They were clouded and unmoving. Dead. Someone laughed, a frantic, mirthless sound that echoed in the small, sealed room, and John looked wildly around for the source. The laughter rose in pitch, growing louder and louder. John covered his ears with his hands as the piercing noise became unbearable.
"Charlie!"
he cried again. John jerked awake, his heart racing. The laughter went on, following him out of the dream. Disoriented, his eyes darted around the room, then lit on the TV, where a clown's painted face filled the screen, caught in a convulsive fit of laughter. John sat up, rubbing his cheek where his watch had been pressing into it. He checked the time, then breathed a sigh of relief. He had just enough time to get to work. He sat back, taking a moment to catch his breath. On the TV screen, a local news anchor was holding a mic up for a man dressed as a circus clown, complete with a painted face, a red nose, and a rainbow-colored wig. Around his neck was a collar that looked like it belonged in a Renaissance painting, and he was wearing a full yellow clown suit with red pom-poms for buttons.
"So, tell me," the anchor said brightly, "did you already have this costume, or did you make it especially for the grand opening?"
John switched the TV off and headed for the shower. He'd been at it all day, but the noise was still unbearable, a rattling, clanging din punctuated by shouts and the intermittent, earth-shaking clatter of jackhammers. John closed his eyes, trying to blot it out. The vibrations resounded in his chest, filling him up, and amid the noise, the sound of desperate laughter suddenly rang in his ears. The figure from his dream came to him again, just out of sight, and he felt as though, if he just turned his head the right way, he could see the face behind the door.
"John!"
John turned. Luis was standing a foot away, giving him a puzzled stare.
"I called your name 3 times, he said.
John shrugged, gesturing at the chaos around them.
"Hey, some of the guys are going out after this. You coming?"
Luis asked. John hesitated.
"Come on, it'll be good for you. All you do is work and sleep."
He laughed good-naturedly and slapped John on the shoulder.
"Right, good for me."
John smiled back, then looked at the ground as the expression faded.
"I just have so much going on right now."
He tried to sound convincing.
"Right, lots going on. Just let me know if you change your mind."
He clapped John on the shoulder again and headed back to the forklift. John watched him stride away. It hadn't been the first time John had turned them down, not the second time or the third, and it occurred to him that eventually they would stop trying, that there'd be a moment when they would all just give up. Maybe that would be for the best.
"John!"
another voice called.
"Now what?"
It was the foreman, shouting at him from the door of his standalone office, a trailer that had been brought on site for the duration of the construction and sat precariously on a dirt ledge. John trudged across the construction zone, ducking through a vinyl sheet in the trailer's doorway. Moments later, he was standing across a folding table from the foreman, the plastic wood-textured paneling barely holding to the walls surrounding him.
"I've got a couple guys out there telling me you're distracted."
"I'm just focused on my job, that's all,"
John said, forcing a smile and trying to prevent his frustration from leaking out. Oliver smiled, unconvincingly.
"Focused," Oliver mimicked.
John dropped the smile, startled. Oliver sighed.
"Look, I gave you a chance because your cousin said you're a hard worker. I overlooked the fact that you walked off your last job and never came back. You know I took a risk on you."
John swallowed.
"Yes, sir, I know."
"Stop with the sir. Just listen to me."
"Look, I do what I'm told. I don't understand the problem."
"Your reactions are slow. You look like you're daydreaming out there. You're not a team player."
What?
This is an active construction zone. If you're in La La Land, or you're not thinking about the safety of the other men out there, someone's going to get hurt or killed. I'm not saying you have to share secrets and braid one another's hair. I'm saying you have to be on the team. They have to trust that you're not going to let them down when it counts.
John gave an understanding nod.
This is a good job, John. I think these are good guys out there, too. Work isn't easy to come by these days, and I need you to get your head in the game. Because next time I see it in the clouds, well, just don't put me in that position. Understand?
Yeah, I understand, John said numbly. He didn't move, standing on the shag brown carpet that came with the portable office, as though waiting to be dismissed from detention.
Okay, get out.
John went. The dressing down had taken up the last few minutes of his workday. He helped Sergei put away some of the equipment, then headed to his car with a muttered goodbye.
Hey!
Sergei called after him. John stopped.
Last call.
John broke off, spotting Oliver out of the corner of his eye.
Maybe next time, he said.
Sergei pressed.
Come on, it's my excuse to avoid that new kid's place. My daughter's been begging to go there all week. Lucy's taking her, but robots creep me out.
John paused, and the world grew silent around him.
What place? John said. So, you coming?
Sergei asked again. John took a few steps backward, as if he'd come too close to a ledge.
Maybe another time, John said, and walked decidedly to his car.
It was old and brownish red, something that might have been cool in high school. Now it was just a reminder that he was still a kid who hadn't moved on, a mark of status that had become a mark of shame within the space of a year. He sat heavily, a plume of dust shooting out the sides of the car seat as he dropped onto it. His hands were shaking. Get a grip. He closed his eyes and clutched the wheel, steadying himself.
This is life now, and you can do it,
he whispered, then opened his eyes and sighed.
Sounds like something lame my dad would have said.
He turned the key. The drive home should have been 10 minutes, but the route he took was closer to half an hour, as it avoided driving through town. If he didn't drive through town, there was no risk of running into people he didn't want to talk to. More importantly, he didn't risk running into the people he did want to talk to. Be a team player. He couldn't muster real resentment toward Oliver. John wasn't a team player. Not anymore. For almost 6 months, he had been coming and going from home to work like a train on a track, stopping to buy food now and then, but not much else. He spoke only when necessary, avoided eye contact. He was startled when people spoke to him, whether they were coworkers saying hello or strangers asking the time. He made conversation, but he was getting better at speaking while walking away. He was always polite, while also making it clear he had somewhere to be, made obvious, when necessary, by suddenly turning in the opposite direction. Sometimes he felt like he was fading away, and it was jarring and disappointing to be reminded that he could still be seen. He pulled into the lot of his apartment complex, a two-story building not really meant for long-term tenants. There was a light in the window of the manager's office. He had tried for a month to track the open hours, then given up, concluding that there was no pattern. He grabbed an envelope from the glove compartment and headed toward the door. He knocked, and there was no response, though inside he could hear sounds of movement. He knocked again, and this time the door opened partially. An old woman with the skin of a lifelong smoker peered out at him.
Hey, Delia.
John smiled.
She didn't smile back. Rent check. John handed an envelope to her.
I know it's late. I came by yesterday, but no one was here.
Was it during business hours? Delia peered into the envelope carefully, as though suspicious of what might be inside.
The lights were off, so...
Then it wasn't during business hours. Delia bared her teeth, but it wasn't really a smile.
I saw you hung up a plant, she said abruptly.
Oh, yeah. John peered over his shoulder toward his apartment, as though he might be able to see it from where they stood.
It's nice to take care of something, right?
John tried to smile again, but quickly gave up, engulfed in a vacuum of judgment that allowed for no levity.
That's allowed, right? To have a plant?
Yes, you can have a plant. Delia took a step back inside and looked poised to close the door.
People don't usually settle in here, that's all. Usually there is a house, then a wife, and then the plant.
Right. John looked down at his shoes.
It's just been a rough...
he began, but the door closed with a firm thunk.
Year.
John considered the door for a minute, then headed to the ground floor apartment at the front of the complex, now his for another month. It was a single-bedroom unit with a full bath and half a kitchen. He kept the blinds up while he was away, to show that he had nothing. The area was prone to burglaries, and it seemed like a safe bet to telegraph the fact that there was nothing to steal here. Once inside, John locked the door behind him and carefully slid the chain into place. His apartment was cool and dark, and quiet. He sighed and rubbed his temples. The headache was still there, but he was growing accustomed to that. The place was sparsely furnished. It had come that way, and the only personal touch he had added to the living room was to stack four cardboard boxes full of books against the wall below the window. He glanced at them with a disappointed familiarity. He went to the bedroom and sat down on his bed, the springs creaking stiffly beneath him. He didn't bother turning on the light. There was enough daylight still leaking through the small, dingy window above his bed. John looked toward his dresser, where a familiar face looked back at him. A toy rabbit's head, its body nowhere to be found.
What did you do today?
John said, meeting the plush rabbit's eyes as if it might show a spark of recognition. Theodore just stared back blankly, his eyes dark and lifeless.
You look terrible. Worse than me.
John stood and approached the rabbit's head. He couldn't ignore the smell of mothballs and dirty fabric. John's smile faded, and he grabbed the head by the ears and held it in the air.
Time to throw you away.
He considered it almost every day. He clenched his jaw, then set it back on the dresser carefully and turned away, not wanting to look at it further. He closed his eyes, not expecting sleep to come, but hoping. He hadn't slept well the night before, or the night before that. He had come to dread sleep. He put it off as long as he could, walking miles of road until late at night, returning home and trying to read, or just staring at the wall. The familiarity was frustrating. He grabbed his pillow and went back to the living room. He lay down on the couch, swinging his legs over the arms so he could fit. The silence in the little apartment was beginning to ring in his ears, and he grabbed the remote off the floor and turned on the TV. The screen was black and white, and the reception was terrible. He could scarcely make out faces through the static, but the chatter of what sounded like a talk show was rapid and cheerful. He turned the volume low and settled back, staring at the ceiling and half-listening to the television voices until slowly he drifted into sleep. Her arm was limp, the only part of her he could see dangling from the twisted metal suit. Blood ran in red rivers down her skin, pooling on the ground, Charlie was all alone. He could hear her voice again if he tried.
Don't let go! John!
She called my name. And then that thing. He shuddered, hearing again the sound of the animatronic suit snapping and crunching. He stared at Charlie's lifeless arm as if the world around them had disappeared, and as the noise echoed in his head, his mind conjured up thoughts unbidden. The crunching sounds were her bones. The tearing was everything else. John opened his eyes with a start. A few feet away, a studio audience laughed, and he looked at the TV, its static and chatter bringing him back to waking life. John sat up, rolling his neck to work out kinks. The couch was too small, and his back was cramped. His head ached, and he was exhausted but restless, the shot of adrenaline still working its way through his system. He went out, locking the door forcefully behind him, and breathed in the night air. He started down the road, heading toward town and whatever might still be open. The lights on the road were far apart, and there was no sidewalk, just a shallow dirt shoulder. Few cars passed him, but when they did, they loomed up from around corners or cresting hills, blinding him with headlights and rushing by with a force that sometimes threatened to knock him back. He had begun to notice himself edging ever closer to the road as he walked, playing a half-hearted game of chicken. When he found himself too far out, he would always take deliberate steps back to the shoulder, and it was always with a secret, sinking disappointment in himself that he would do so. As he approached town, lights pierced the darkness once again, and he shielded his eyes and took a step back from the road. This one slowed as it passed, then came to a sudden stop. John turned and walked a few steps toward it as the driver's window rolled down.
John?
Someone called. The car went into reverse and haphazardly pulled onto the shoulder. John jumped out of its path. A woman stepped out and took a few quick steps toward him, as if she might try to hug him, but he stayed planted where he was, his arms stiff at his sides, and she stopped a few feet away.
John, it's me,
Jessica said with a smile that quickly faded.
What are you doing out here?
She asked. She was wearing short sleeves, and she rubbed her arms against the night air, glancing back and forth along the near deserted road.
Well, I could ask you the same thing, he answered as though she had accused him of something.
Jessica pointed over John's shoulder.
Gas.
She smiled brightly at him, and he couldn't help but mirror her a little. He had almost forgotten this ability of hers, to turn on cheerful goodwill like a faucet, splashing it all over everyone.
How have you been?
She asked cautiously.
Fine. Working, mostly.
He gestured down at the dusty work clothes he hadn't bothered to change out of.
What's new with you?
He asked, suddenly aware of the absurdity of the conversation as cars passed nearby.
I really have to be going. Have a good night.
He turned and began to walk away without giving her a chance to speak.
I miss seeing you around, Jessica called. And so does she.
John paused, digging at the dirt with one foot.
Listen.
Jessica took a few quick steps to catch up to him.
Carlton's going to be in town for a couple of weeks. It's spring break. We're all getting together.
She waited expectantly, but he didn't respond.
He's dying to show off his new cosmopolitan persona,
Jessica added brightly.
When I talked to him on the phone last week, he was faking a Brooklyn accent to see if I'd notice.
She forced a giggle. John smiled fleetingly.
Who else is going to be there?
He asked, looking directly at her for the first time since she got out of the car. Jessica's eyes narrowed.
John, you have to talk to her sometime.
Why is that?
He said brusquely and started walking again.
John, wait!
Behind him, John heard her break into a run. She caught up quickly, slowing to jog beside him, matching his pace.
I can do this all day, she warned, but John didn't answer. You have to talk to her, Jessica repeated.
He gave her a sharp look. Charlie's dead, he said harshly, the words rasping in his throat. It had been a long time since he spoke the words aloud. Jessica stopped in her tracks. He kept going.
John, at least talk to me.
He didn't answer.
You're hurting her, she added.
He stopped walking.
Don't you understand what you're doing to her? After what she went through? It's insane, John. I don't know what that night did to you, but I know what it did to Charlie. And you know what? I don't think anything hurt as badly as having you refuse to speak to her. To say she's dead.
I saw her die. John stared out into the city lights.
No, you didn't, Jessica said,
then hesitated.
Look, I'm worried about you.
I'm just lost. John turned to her. And after what I've been through, after what we've been through, that's not an unreasonable reaction.
He waited a moment for her to respond, then looked away. I get it. I really do. I thought she was dead too.
John opened his mouth to speak, but she pressed on.
I thought she was dead until she turned up, alive.
Jessica pulled at John's shoulder until he met her eyes again.
I've seen her, Jessica said, her voice breaking. I've talked to her. It is her. And this...
She let go of his shoulder and waved her hand over him as though casting a spell.
This thing that you're doing, that's what's killing her.
It's not her, John whispered.
Okay,
Jessica snapped and turned on her heel. She walked back to the car and after a few moments pulled back out into the road, then made a screeching U-turn. John stayed where he was. Jessica roared past him, then stopped abruptly, her brakes squealing, then backed up to where he stood.
We're meeting at Clay's house on Saturday, she said tiredly. Please.
He looked at her. She wasn't crying, but her eyes were shiny, her face red. He nodded. Maybe.
Good enough for me. I'll see you there, Jessica said.
Then she drove off without another word, the engine roaring in the quiet of the night. I said maybe, John muttered into the darkness. Chapter 2. The pencil squeaked against the paper as the man at the desk carefully filled out the form in front of him. He paused suddenly, a wave of dizziness overtaking him. The letters on the page were fuzzy, and he adjusted his reading glasses, his head swimming. The glasses made no difference, and he took them off and rubbed his eyes. Then, just as suddenly as it had come, the sensation was gone. The room righted itself, and the words on the page were perfectly clear. He scratched his beard, still disconcerted, then began to steadily write again. A ring sounded and the front door opened.
Yes, sir,
he barked without looking up.
I wanted to have a look around the yard,
a woman's voice echoed softly.
Oh, pardon me, ma'am.
The man looked up and smiled momentarily, then went back to his form, writing as he talked.
Scrap is 50 cents a pound. It might be more if you find a specific part, but we can see when you come back in. Just go have a look around. You have to bring your own tools, but we can help you load it up when you're ready to leave.
I'm looking for something specific.
The woman peered down at him, observing his name tag. Bob, she added belatedly.
Well, I don't know what to tell you.
He set his pencil down, then reclined and crossed his arms behind his head.
It's a dump.
He laughed.
We try to at least separate the junk cars from the tin cans, but what you see is what you get.
Bob, you received several truckloads of scrap metal on this date and from this location. The woman set a piece of paper down on top of the form Bob had been working on. Bob picked it up and adjusted his reading glasses, then looked up at her over them.
Well, as I said, it's a dump, he said slowly, growing more concerned as the moments passed. I might be able to point you in the right direction. I mean, we don't catalog the stuff.
The woman walked around the side of the desk, stepping up beside Bob's chair, and he straightened nervously in his seat. I hear you boys had some trouble here last night, she said casually.
No trouble. Bob furrowed his brow. Some kids snuck in. It happens.
That's not what I heard. The woman studied a picture on the wall. Your daughters? She asked lightly.
Yes, 2 and 5.
They are beautiful. She paused. Do you treat them well? Bob was taken aback.
Of course I do, he said, trying to hide his indignation.
There was a long pause. The woman tilted her head, still looking at the picture. I heard you called the police because you thought someone was trapped in the scrap heaps out there, she said. Bob didn't answer. I heard, the woman continued, leaning in closer to the picture, that you thought you heard screaming and sounds of distress and panic. Something was trapped. A child was trapped, you thought. Maybe several.
Look, we run a clean business and we have a good reputation.
I'm not disputing your reputation. Quite the opposite. I think what you did was honorable, running to the rescue in the middle of the night, cutting your legs on jagged scraps of metal as you ran blindly through the yard.
How do you...
Bob's voice trembled, and he stopped talking. He moved his legs under the desk, hoping to hide the bandages that bulged out visibly under both pant legs. What did you find? The woman asked. He didn't answer. What was there? She pressed. When you got on your hands and knees and crawled through the beams and the wire, what was there?
Nothing, he whispered. Nothing was there.
And the police? They found nothing?
No, nothing. There wasn't anything. I went out again today just to be...
He spread his hands on the desk in front of him, collecting his nerves.
We run a good business, he said firmly. I don't feel comfortable talking about this. If I'm in some kind of trouble, then I think...
You're not in any trouble, Bob, as long as you can do me one little favor.
What's that?
Simple. The woman leaned over Bob, bracing herself on the arms of his chair, so close her face almost touched his. Take me there. John pulled into the parking lot at the construction site and immediately saw Oliver standing in front of the gate of the chain-link fence. His arms were crossed, and he was chewing on something, his face grim. When it became clear that he wasn't going to move out of the way, John slowed to a stop and got out.
What's going on? He asked.
Oliver continued to chew on whatever was in his mouth.
I have to let you go, he said at last. You're late, again. I'm not late, John protested, then glanced at his watch. I mean, not by much, he amended. Come on, Oliver. It won't happen again. I'm sorry. Me too, Oliver said. Good luck, John. Oliver, John called.
Oliver let himself in through the gate and glanced back one more time before walking away. John leaned against his car for a moment. Several co-workers were staring at him, suddenly turning away as John noticed them. John got in his car and headed back the way he had come. When he returned to his apartment, John sat down on the edge of his bed and buried his face in his hands. "Now what?" he wondered aloud and glanced around the room, his eyes lit on his only decoration. "You still look terrible," he said to Theodore's disembodied head. "And you're still in worse shape than me." The notion of attending the party that night suddenly returned to him. The thought of it set off a nervous fluttering in his stomach, but he wasn't sure what it was, anxiety or excitement. "I thought she was dead too," Jessica had said the night before. "I've seen her. I've talked to her. It is her." John closed his eyes. What if it is her? He saw it again, the moment he always saw. The shuddering suit, Charlie trapped inside as it crunched and jerked, and then her hand and the blood. She couldn't have survived that. But another image came to mind, unbidden. Dave, who became Springtrap. He had survived what happened to Charlie. He had worn the yellow rabbit suit like it was a second skin, and had paid for it twice. The scars that covered his torso like a shirt of gruesome lace told the story of one narrow escape, and the second? Charlie had killed him when she tripped the spring locks, or so they all believed. No one could have survived what they saw, and yet he had returned. For an instant, John pictured Charlie, scarred and broken, yet miraculously alive. "But that doesn't sound like the person Jessica saw," John spoke clearly to Theodore. "Someone broken and scarred. That's not who Jessica was describing." He shook his head. "That's not the person I saw at the diner." The next day, she looked like she'd just stepped out of a fairy tale. John caught himself and shook his head, trying to focus on the present. He really didn't know what had happened to Charlie. He felt himself edging toward the glimmer of hope. Maybe I was wrong. Maybe she's all right. It was what he'd wished for, what anyone wishes for in the throes of grief. Let it not have happened. Let everything be all right. The precarious ledge became solid ground, and John felt a weight lifted, his neck and shoulders relaxing from a cramped position he had not been aware of. The fatigue from so many months of misspent sleep caught up to him all at once. He looked at Theodore. He was clutching the rabbit's head so tightly that his knuckles had gone white. He slowly released the toy, propping it up on the pillow. "I'm not going," he said. "I was never really considering it. I just wanted Jessica to leave me alone." He held his breath for a moment, then let out a deep sigh. "Right?" he said, his tone becoming more agitated. "What would I even say to these people?" Theodore stared at him blankly. "Damn." John sighed. The fluttering in John's stomach grew worse the closer he came to Clay's house. He checked the dashboard clock. It was only 6. Maybe no one will be there yet, he thought. But as he made his way down the winding road toward their house, cars lined both sides of the street for half a block. John wedged his car between a pickup truck and a rusted sedan almost as beat up as his own, then got out and headed toward the house. All the windows of the 3-story house were illuminated, standing out against the trees like a beacon. John hung back, staying out of the light. He could hear music from inside, and laughter. The sound of it made him balk. He forced himself to walk the rest of the way to the door, but stopped again when he reached it. Going inside felt like an enormous decision, something that would change everything. Then again, so did walking away. He raised his hand to ring the bell, then hesitated. Before he could decide, the door swung open in front of him. John blinked at the sudden light and found himself face to face with Clay Burke, who looked as startled as he was.
John!
Clay reached out and gripped John with both arms, pulled him in and gave him a hug, then quickly pushed him back to where he started and firmly patted his shoulders.
Right, come in.
Clay stepped back to clear the way, and John followed him in, looking around the room cautiously. The last time he was here, the whole house had been a wreck, strewn with signs of a man falling to pieces. Now, the piles of laundry and evidence files were gone. The couches and the floor were clean, and Clay himself was beaming with a genuine smile. He caught John's eye, and his grin faded.
A lot has changed.
He smiled as though reading John's mind.
Is Betty?
John broke off too late. He shook his head.
Sorry, I didn't mean to. No, she's still gone,
Clay said evenly.
I wish she'd come back. Maybe she will someday, but life goes on, he added with a brief smile.
John nodded, uncertain what to say.
John!
Marla waved from the stairs and immediately came bounding down with her usual eagerness, wrapping him in a hug before he could so much as say hello. Jessica appeared, coming in from the kitchen.
Hey, John,
Jessica said more calmly, but with a glowing smile.
I'm so glad to see you again. It's been a long time,
Marla said, releasing him at last.
Yeah, he said. Too long.
He tried to think of something else to say, and Marla and Jessica exchanged a glance. Jessica opened her mouth, about to speak, but was interrupted as Carlton ran excitedly down the staircase.
Carlton,
John called with his first genuine smile of the evening. Carlton raised his hand in an answering wave and came to join the group.
Hey,
he said.
Hey,
John echoed as Carlton tousled John's hair.
What, are you my granddad now?
John made a half-hearted effort to straighten his hair while searching the crowd with his eyes.
I'm surprised you came.
Marla slapped him across the shoulder.
I mean, of course you were going to come,
Carlton corrected.
I just know you've been busy. Too many girlfriends, am I right? How's New York?
John asked, fishing for something to talk about as he straightened his clothes.
Great. College, city, learning, friends. I was in a play about a horse. It's great.
He bobbed his head in a rapid nod.
Marla's in school, too.
In Ohio,
Marla jumped in.
I'm pre-med.
That's great.
John grinned.
Yeah, it's been a lot of hard work, but it's worth it, she said cheerfully,
and John began to relax, falling back into the familiar pattern of their friendships. Marla was still Marla. Carlton was still inscrutable.
Is Lamar around?
Carlton asked, looking from face to face. Marla shook her head.
I called him when... a few months ago, she said. He's on track to graduate early.
But he's not coming?
Carlton persisted. Marla smiled slightly.
He said, I'm never, ever, ever setting foot in that town again, not ever, never for as long as I live, and you shouldn't either. But he said we're all welcome to visit him.
In New Jersey?
Carlton made a skeptical face, then turned his attention to Jessica.
Jessica, what's up with you these days anyway? I heard you've got the dorm room to yourself now.
John stiffened, suddenly aware of what Carlton was really asking. The lights seemed blinding, the noise louder. Jessica glanced at John, but he didn't acknowledge her.
Yeah,
she said, turning back to the others.
I don't know what happened, but I came home one day right after, about 6 months ago, and she was packing what she could carry. She left me and John to clean up the rest. If we hadn't happened to walk in, I don't think she was even going to tell me she was leaving. Did she say where she was going? Marla asked, her brow furrowing. Jessica shook her head. She hugged me and said she'd miss me, but all she'd say was she had to leave. She wouldn't tell me where.
Well, we can always ask her, Carlton said. John looked at him, startled. You've seen her?
Carlton shook his head.
Not yet. My plane just got in today. But she'll be here tonight. Jessica says she looks good.
Right, John said. They all looked at him as if they could see what he was thinking. She looks good, but she doesn't look like Charlie.
John, come help me in the kitchen, Clay called,
and John broke away from the group relieved, but also fully aware he couldn't possibly provide any help in the kitchen.
What's up? He asked.
Clay leaned back against the sink and looked him up and down.
Need me to open the ketchup bottle?
John asked, growing nervous.
High shelf?
Clay sighed.
I just want to make sure you're all right out there.
What do you mean?
I thought you might be nervous. I know it's been a while since you and Charlie talked.
It's been a while since you and I have talked, too, John said, unable to keep the edge out of his voice.
Well, that's different, and you know it, Clay said dryly. I thought you might need a pep talk.
A pep talk? John retorted. Clay shrugged.
Well, do you?
Clay stared at him firmly, but with kindness in his eyes, and John's nerves calmed.
Jessica told you?
He asked, and Clay tilted his head to the side.
Some, probably not all. Here.
Clay opened the refrigerator door he had been leaning against and handed John a soda.
Try to relax. You're here with friends. Those people out there love you.
Clay smiled.
I know, John said, setting the can on the countertop next to him.
He eyed it for a second but did not pick it up, feeling like if he drank it, he would be giving in, accepting everything he was told. It would be like taking whatever pill everyone else had already swallowed.
John eyed the back door.
Don't even think about it, Clay said abruptly.
John didn't try to pretend it wasn't what he was thinking. Clay sighed.
I know how hard this must be for you.
Do you?
John responded sharply, but Clay's expression didn't change.
Stay and talk to her. I think you owe that to her, and to yourself.
John's eyes were still fixed on the door.
All of this heartache that you're putting yourself through, that can't be what you want.
Clay leaned to the side, interrupting John's gaze.
You're right, John said.
He stood up straight and met Clay's eyes.
This isn't what I want.
He went to the back door and pushed it open, rushing down the concrete steps as though Clay might pursue him, then walking around the side of the house toward his car, his heart pounding. He felt a little lightheaded and completely unsure he was making the right decision.
John!
Someone called from behind him. The familiar voice sent a jolt through him, and he stopped, closing his eyes for a second. He heard her heels tapping on the stone walk, the sound vanishing as she crossed the grass to him. He opened his eyes and turned toward the voice. She was standing a few feet from him.
Thanks for stopping, Charlie said.
Her face was anxious, her arms wrapped tightly across her body like she was cold, despite the mild weather.
I was just going to get my jacket, John said,
trying to sound casual in the midst of an obvious lie. He looked her up and down, and she didn't move, like she knew what he was doing and why.
It's not her.
She looked like some stunning cousin of Charlie's, maybe, but not her. Not the round-faced, frizzy-haired, awkward girl he had known almost all his life. She was taller, thinner, her hair longer, darker. Her face was uncannily different, though he could not have explained how. Her posture, even as she stood hugging herself in anxiety, was somehow elegant. As he looked at her, the first shock of recognition gave way to an acute revulsion. He took an involuntary step back. How can anyone think that's her? He thought. How can anyone think that's my Charlie? She bit her lip.
John, say something, she said, pleading in her voice.
He shrugged, holding both hands up in resignation.
I don't know what to say, he admitted.
She nodded. She uncrossed her arms as if she had just realized she was holding them that way, and began to pick at her nails instead.
I'm so happy to see you, she said, sounding like she was about to cry.
John softened, but tamped the feeling down.
Me too, he said in a monotone.
I missed you, she began, searching his face for something.
John had no idea what he might look like, but he felt like stone.
I had to get away for a while, she went on uncertainly. That night, John, I thought I was going to die.
I thought you did, he said,
trying to swallow the lump rising in his throat. She hesitated.
You don't think I'm me? She asked softly at last.
He looked down at his feet for a moment, unable to say the words to her face.
Jessica told me. It's okay, John, she said. I just want you to know that it's okay.
Her eyes were bright with tears. His heart lurched, and in an instant, the world came into a different focus. He gazed at the woman huddled in front of him trying to suppress her sobs. The stark differences he saw in her were suddenly things that seemed so easily explained. Her shoes had heels, so she was taller. She was wearing a form-fitting dress instead of her usual jeans and t-shirt, so she appeared thinner. She was wearing elegant clothing, and her gestures were confident, sophisticated. But it was all no more than if Jessica had given her the makeover she was always threatening. No more than if Charlie had just grown up. We've all had to grow up. John thought of the way he drove home from work, or had until this morning, the way he avoided ever driving past her house, or the sight of Freddy Fazbear's. Maybe Charlie had things she wanted to avoid. Maybe she just wanted to be different. Maybe she wanted to change, like you did. When you think of that moment, what it did to you, what must it have done to her? What kind of nightmares do you have, Charlie? He was seized by a sudden, visceral desire to ask her, and for the first time he allowed himself to meet her eyes. His stomach jolted as he did, his heart racing. Tentatively, she smiled at him, and he smiled back, unconsciously mirroring her, but something frigid twitched inside him. Those aren't her eyes. John shifted his gaze, a calm coming over him. Charlie looked momentarily confused.
Charlie, John said carefully, do you remember the last thing I said to you? Before you were trapped in the suit?
She held his gaze for a moment, then shook her head.
I'm sorry, John, she said. I don't remember a lot about that night. Whole pieces are just missing. I remember being in the suit. I passed out, I think, for hours.
So you don't remember, he repeated gravely.
It seemed impossible that she could have forgotten. Maybe she didn't hear me.
Were you hurt?
He asked brusquely. She nodded silently, her eyes filling again with tears, and she hugged herself. This time she didn't look cold. She looked like she was in pain. Maybe she was. John took a step closer to her, wanting suddenly, desperately, to promise her that everything would be all right. But then her eyes met his again, and he stopped, stepped back. She extended a hand, but he didn't take it, and again she crossed her arms over her body. "John, would you meet me tomorrow?" she asked steadily.
"Why?"
he said before he could stop himself, but she did not react. "I just want to talk. Give me a chance." Her voice rose shakily, and he nodded.
"Sure. Yeah, I'll meet you tomorrow."
He paused.
"That same place, okay?"
he added carefully, waiting to see how she would reply. "The Italian place? Our first date?" she said easily, and gave a gentle smile. Her tears seemed to have stopped. "Around 6? John let out a deep breath.
"Yeah."
He met her gaze again and did not look away, letting himself take rest in her eyes for the first time that night. She looked back at him, motionless, like she was afraid she might scare him away. John nodded, then turned and left without another word. He walked quickly back to his car, struggling to keep his pace even. He felt like he had done something wonderful, and also like he had made a horrible mistake. He felt strange, riding an adrenaline rush, and as he drove through the dark, he pictured her face again. Those weren't her eyes. Charlie watched him go, rooted to the spot as if it were the only place she'd ever stood. "He doesn't believe me." Jessica had not wanted to tell her about John's strange yet adamant conviction, but his refusal to speak to her now, his unwillingness even to acknowledge her presence that day in the diner, was too bizarre to be dismissed. "How can he think I'm not me?" The taillights of John's car vanished around a bend. Charlie stared into the dark where he had been, not wanting to return to the bright, noisy house. Carlton would tell her a joke. Jessica and Marla would comfort her the way they had in the diner that day, when she had come to show them that somehow, impossibly, she had survived. The walk from her car, really Aunt Jen's borrowed car, toward the diner had felt like miles that day, her stomach fluttering anxiously even though she knew, of course, that they would be happy to see her. How could they not be? Every step was stiff, uncertain. Every time she moved, it hurt. Her body sore all over from the day before, though there were no marks on her to show it. Even breathing was strained and unfamiliar, and she had a persistent feeling that if she forgot to do it, she would stop, die of asphyxiation right there on the pavement, unless she was reminded, "Take a breath." She could see them through the window as she made her way to the front of the diner, her heart racing. And then they saw her, and it was everything she had dared to hope. Marla and Jessica ran to the door, jostling over who would hug her first, crying at the sight of her living face. She let herself be wrapped in the warmth of their relief. But before they even let her go, she was looking for John. When she saw him, his back to the door, she almost called out his name, but something stopped her. He said something she could not hear, and she watched, incredulous, as he failed to come to her, clenching a spoon in his hand like a weapon. "John!" she called at last, but he did not turn around. Marla and Jessica ushered her out of the restaurant, making reassuring sounds that must have been words, and Charlie strained to see him through the window. He had not moved. How can he pretend I'm not here? A shock of pain hit her suddenly.